On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. We begin with Dr. Gary LaFree, a terrorism expert from the University of Maryland. We'll find out how the latest data on terrorism may inform the world's response to ISIS. Next, the status of Charm City schools. What's the best way to make them more equitable for all students? What's new in the conflict surrounding public charter schools? We'll ask longtime educator and former Baltimore City School Board member, Dr. David Stone. And we ask you to help us choose a new theme song. We'll give you 5 samples to choose from, and we'll talk to the creative director of original music at Clean Cuts Music about the art of matching music to Maryland Morning. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick has her review of The Secret Garden at Baltimore's Center Stage. Matt's got the local news. First, the national headlines.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Thanks, Matt. Good morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. This morning, we're going to take a look at the Baltimore City Schools with David Stone, a former school board member and an education expert at the Kennedy Krieger. But first, joining me on the phone from Long Island City, New York, is Dr. Gary LaFree. He is a professor of criminology and criminal justice at the University of Maryland. He's also the director of START, the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism. Dr. LaFree, good morning. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Tom. Good to be here.
So you all have been releasing data as recently as yesterday. You continue to release it today on your website, and we'll have a link to that website so folks can take a look at it in detail. But you've done a lot of thinking about these coordinated attacks, the kind that we saw in Beirut and Paris last week. What have you learned since last weekend?
Correct. Well, I guess to put things into context, it unfortunately happens more than you might think. Lots of countries in the world actually have had, unfortunately, a lot of experience with these coordinated attacks. When we go back all the way back to 2000, we are finding about 29 cases, for example, in Iraq. Nigeria has 13, Pakistan, India, Syria, a number of countries where you're getting a lot of casualties in a single day. It's been much rarer in Western Europe and North America, and of course, the French case, this is by far the most lethal attack, certainly in France, probably for a half century, involving terrorism. Unfortunately, though, it's not that uncommon in other parts of the world.
You refer to this kind of event as a black swan event. What do you mean by that terminology?
Black swan refers to the idea that a really high-profile attack such as this one, such as, for example, the 9/11 attacks or the attacks in Madrid or London or Mumbai, end up really galvanizing public opinion, can have a huge impact. It's impossible not to respond to them. The public demands it. I think the politicians cannot resist it, essentially, even though when you look at a database such as our database, which collects information on every single terrorist attack in the world, these are very rare events. So you have a situation where the black swan, the rare event, ends up having a huge impact on public policy.
You've also talked about how these events tend to be bursty. What do you mean by that sophisticated sounding
term? Yeah, unfortunately, I think this is a good example. When we look at these coordinated attacks, ISIL or Daesh, whatever we want to call this organization, has had a disproportionate effect. Huge number of attacks that are these sort of coordinated attacks we trace to either ISIS or Al-Qaeda in the past. We're now getting into dozens of these attacks. So we say bursty in the sense that once a terrorist organization finds an attack method that they find to be doing what they are hoping it will do, they tend to do it a lot until governments and politicians and so on figure out a way to resist it.
The FBI is assisting French authorities in trying to track down the people responsible for the event in Paris. You've done a lot of thought and a lot of research into this notion of homegrown terrorists. There seem to be a couple in this instance that are French nationals, some Belgian nationals, a Syrian national who got into the country with the wave of migrants. What is the difference between the homegrown terrorists, for example, here in the United States, folks that, you know, have a sympathy or somewhat empathetic towards ISIS and those who actually then go so far as to leave the country and, you know, go to Syria and train, et cetera?
I think essentially what we would think about in terms of distinguishing homegrown from other kinds of terrorist action is three things. One, where the country where the attack takes place. Two, the nationality of the perpetrators. And three, the nationality of the targets. So when all of those line up, we would normally call it a homegrown incident, otherwise an international incident. And we're finding, basically, international incidents and this kind of hybrid one that you're finding here in Paris are, they fit into this black swan model. They're very rare. People find them, I think, especially frightening. And they tend to have a disproportionate impact on public policy. So think back, for example, 9/11, think back Mumbai, think back Madrid, think back London. So even though they're uncommon, they tend to have a huge impact on our thinking about terrorism, our stereotypes of terrorism, and ultimately on the impact on social policy.
And your advice then to policymakers would be to maybe take a deep breath, take a step back, and not do anything in a knee-jerk way?
Definitely. This is the thing about terrorism. It's designed to provoke a quick and perhaps not carefully thought-out approach. So, I mean, if there's ever an area where you would hope you'd have objective reason thinking, you collect as much information as you can before you act, I think would be exactly in this case, and certainly in dealing with an organization like ISIL.
Well, Dr. LaFrie, I appreciate your time. When you're back in town, we'll have you in the studio, and we'll have a more extensive conversation about this very important topic. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Look forward to it, Tom. Thank you.
Dr. Gary LaFrie is a professor of criminology at the University of Maryland and the director of START, the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism. Now we're going to turn to education in Baltimore City with Dr. David Stone. He's a longtime educator who served on the Baltimore City School Board from 2002 until 2004, when he resigned from the board to become director of charter schools for the Baltimore City Public Schools. In 2008, Mayor Sheila Dixon reappointed him to the school board, where he served until September of this year. So he's served 9 years altogether on the school board, three of those years as its vice chairman. And since 2007, he's also been assistant vice president for special education at the Kennedy Krieger Institute here in Baltimore. David Stone, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. Let's start with the news. Dr. Gregory Thornton, the CEO of the city schools, has recommended closing five public schools, including two charter schools, the Maritime Industries Academy High School, Baltimore Community High School, and Westside Elementary School, plus the two charters, Roots and Branches, and the Maryland Academy of Technology and Health Sciences. Every year, CEOs recommend closing this school or that. Sometimes it's a dozen, sometimes it's a half a dozen. There will be public hearings about this soon. The school board will vote on these recommendations in January. One of the schools, Westside Elementary, is in the Penn North neighborhood, the epicenter of the protests around Freddie Gray. Your thoughts about his Dr. Thornton's choice of schools for this go-around of closings?
The school system's fairly methodical about how they close schools. There's a process, and it's the same for every school, whether it's a charter or a traditional school. Personally, I'm not sure that closing schools is the right move. I don't think there's research that supports it lately. Over the years, it's been one of the things that school districts can do to help the school system get better, but I'm not sure. We haven't done much study on what happens to the kids who leave those schools, so I guess that would be the first question I had.
Because certainly in many cases, they're going to have to leave their own neighborhood and go to a school in a different neighborhood.
They try to keep it as close as possible.
Yeah.
But we have too many seats in the school system, and that costs money. And for every extra seat we have, there's money that comes out of other classrooms. Certainly Delegate Hayes, I understand, it's his community, and he is right to advocate for his school, but I think the hardest thing a school board and a superintendent have to do is close schools. It's never good.
Talk about the charter schools. There are 14 charter schools that are currently suing the Baltimore City Public Schools. What's all that about? Sort that out for us.
Sure. let me begin by saying a charter school, clear up a few misconceptions. A charter school is, in every sense of the word, a public school. They are also under the oversight of the Baltimore City School Board, which is something that's different than in most states where the school system, the folks that give out the charter or the agreement are called authorizers. And in some states, there are multiple authorizers. And in some states, the charter schools themselves become their own school district. But in Maryland, it's not like that. And what folks think is the weakness of our laws, frankly, I think is our strength. In terms of the lawsuit, this isn't a new thing. This is something that's been going on since my office put out the first funding formula back in 2004. Two of the charter schools took us to the State Board of Education, and we lost. And then it was appealed to higher courts, and eventually the charter schools prevailed again. And some of it has to do with the funding. I think that's what we're really talking about right now, is the funding formula. Charter schools are meant to get their funds based on a formula that the state and the Court of Special Appeals laid out very plainly. And for the last 10 years, the school system has failed to be responsive to those decisions.
So is it really, it's a question of how much and how the formula, how those funds are decided, what the calculus is to give the schools the money that they're going to get.
Absolutely. One of the areas of contention is the idea of giving services instead of cash. The law says clearly that funds are to be dispersed, and the court said funds meant cash, but the school system continues to give out services instead of that. The other area of contention has to do with the 2% administrative fee that charter schools are meant to give back for the services that they get, that every school gets. And what exactly is comprised of those services is not clear to anyone, including me.
Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake asked former Mayor Kurt Schmoke to arbitrate this dispute. It appears that he threw up his hand and said, nope, can't do this, and he kind of walked away. What do you read into that? We have just a few seconds before we take a break.
Sure, absolutely. What I think the problem there was that the charter schools were, in my opinion, were being rather flexible, but the school system insisted on them dropping the lawsuit with prejudice, meaning they could not bring it back again. And I don't blame them for not doing that. It seems, why would you give up your only defense?
Dr. Stone, every state defines charter schools differently. You talked about, some of the differences in Maryland as opposed to other places. Who can attend charter schools in terms of access? Is it open to everybody?
Everyone.
Or is it limited?
Everyone can apply to a charter school. And when they apply, nothing about them, let's say if they were a student with a disability and might have an individualized education program, that you wouldn't find that out until after the student was accepted. So the notion that charter schools cream is a little unfair.
By cream, I mean they cherry pick. The cream of the crop. They get the best students, and then that means their scores are better than the other schools.
Right. Well, the applications that charter schools submit have a marketing plan attached to it. Second of all, I do think it's incumbent upon the school system to provide that information to families. I don't know why the charter schools are responsible completely for that. The school system does not do a good job of getting the information out, especially to children of children in elementary school. The other thing that's
so there are parents who just may assume that their kids got to go to the school that's down the street from right. In their neighborhood, but they could in fact apply to any charter school. It's not limited geographically.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Although the barrier remains of transportation, and I think that's one of the issues. And again, I think if the school system were truly interested in equity the way that they describe it, they would come up with a system of transporting students so that everyone had access to a charter school. Naturally, if I'm a parent that has a car and is able to drop my kid off, that makes a big difference than someone who has to take three buses. So that's an area that really needs to be addressed.
So what about those who have the sense that charters are simply asking for more money at the expense of the traditional schools, the regular schools? The neighborhood schools, whatever you call them.
I think that is a manufactured argument, quite frankly. I don't think it's easy to compare the schools. Charter schools pay actual costs for things. Traditional schools pay average costs, especially for salaries, which make up the bulk of their. So that can be a big difference. A school like Roland Park that has a lot of experienced teachers only is responsible for the average salary, where if they were paying actual salary, it would probably be much more. That's one of the areas I think that is very different between the two. And then taking the money, charter schools, last I saw, were asking for around $10,000 a kid. So if there's 85,000 kids in the school system, that's $850 million. We get $1.4 billion, so I just wonder where the other $600 million is going.
Yeah, you've been your tenure on the school system board was distinguished by being one of the only people who tended to ask questions about the budget. There's a lot of questions about the transparency of the city school system's budget and the lack thereof. The school board approves
the budget? I mean, you were given numbers. I mean, surely you looked at budgets that, you know, had more detail than what we'd see on a website or what, you know, what anybody else would have access to.
Actually, I don't think that's true. I think we saw the same information that the public eventually saw. We may have seen it first, but the level of detail is totally insufficient in the school board budget. They have line items like mid-level administrator, which means a lot to the folks at Maryland State Department of Education, but to a parent, it means nothing. What I know that I've been asking for and others has been a programmatic budget, a budget that describes which programs are getting which dollars. For example, it's impossible to tell how much we spend on gifted education in the school system, an area where I think that we're very weak. And the school board's budget needs to be much more transparent. Much more.
And when the staff of the school system presents the budget to the board, they're not able to explain that in that kind of detail? I mean, how gritty can you get when you're talking about this before you give a yay or nay vote on it?
Mm. We do ask a lot of questions, but sometimes when the information's presented, you're not sure which questions are the right questions. There's a lot of information packed in there, and for 9 volunteers to pour through it as if there was their full-time job, I think is unreasonable, which is why we need much more clarity in the original documents that we get. I mean, there are endless questions. We could go on and on and on, but there just seems to be a shorter and shorter time. To Dr. Thornton's credit, they are starting the process earlier now, and hopefully that will give folks more opportunity to ask questions, which they absolutely should. Because mm-hmm. there's a lot of disparities in that budget.
And the problems with the disparities, the problems with the transparency, these predate Dr. Thornton?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. From the first day I was on the board. The very first day in 2002 that I got on the school board, that weekend we found out we were beginning the deficit that ended in a $58 million deficit that Dr. Copeland was able to get us out of.
Mm-hmm. This conflict between charters and traditional schools, when you look in your crystal ball, how does this thing get fixed?
Well, I think we're at a very different place than we have been for the last 10 years, which is why the charter schools have taken the dramatic move of doing a lawsuit, and that's simply because Dr. Thornton has approached this very differently than other superintendents. I find it hard to believe that this will be resolved while Dr. Thornton is superintendent. The only way it would happen is if the state board took a hand in it or the state legislature and really defined the funding formula. But for now, if the school system isn't willing to accept that there's a decision by two legal bodies, then it makes it very difficult to start a conversation. And I think that's very frustrating for the charter schools, and I don't blame them.
We have asked Dr. Thornton to be on the program numerous times over the last few weeks. It's not that he said no. It's just that he and his office haven't responded one way or the other. They haven't said yes, no, or anything. So, Dr. Thornton, if your staff is listening, we would be delighted to have you on the show to talk about some of these things. Dr. Stone, what is your what are you hearing about the level of support that Dr. Thornton enjoys in the community, on the board, with the staff, with the faculty, with parents? There's a lot of people who are questioning his leadership.
I don't know what I know specifically about that. I do know that folks are concerned about things like test scores dropping, about special education. We got out of a 27-year lawsuit, and now we are dangerously close to slipping back. So I'm not sure what to say about support. I do know that many people have many questions.
Talk about special ed. This is an area that you're quite well versed in and quite erudite. What's your take on how the city's school system is handling the special education mandates and challenges?
First of all, let me say that working with students with disabilities can be very taxing and can be very expensive. I know at my school we charge large tuitions for students because they need a lot of services. But the school system doesn't seem to have a plan for bringing those students who are more than a year behind to grade level. Students who are behind in grade level can't make a year's worth of progress and ever expect to catch up. There's a program called One Year Plus that a former board member, Buzzy Hedelman, put forth, and certainly, the notion is absolutely correct. Kids will have to make more than a year's worth of gains, but the school system seems to not really have a notion of how to implement that or worked with the community to try to get their input. And as a result, there are students in some classes that ought not to be because they are much more disabled than the teachers can handle. The training isn't very good. People who are running the IEP meetings. The meetings where student services are determined and their
individual
goals for the year.
Education
individual
plans.
Education mm-hmm. program, mm-hmm. right? Those folks aren't giving the proper training, so.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Stone, I appreciate your time this morning. Give us a little background into some very complicated stuff, and we'll have you back to talk more about
Thanks.
It.
Thanks. Anytime.
David Stone served on the Baltimore City School Board for 9 years, including 3 years as the board's vice chairman. He's the assistant vice president for special ed at the Kennedy Krieger Institute here in Baltimore. There's a meeting on Saturday morning at Morgan State from 10 to 1 of the subcommittee of the Baltimore City delegation of the Maryland legislature. We understand Dr. Gregory Thornton will be at that meeting. We'll have a link on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Lots more ahead. Stay with us.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
April of next year, Maryland Morning will celebrate its 10th anniversary here on WYPR. Sheila Cast, Nathan Sterner, and I launched the show on April 21st, 2006. For the first few months, this was our theme music.
From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning.
So this music was composed by Thomas Newman, an acclaimed film composer. One of his most recent projects was the music for Bridge of Spies, the Steven Spielberg movie that stars Tom Hanks. The music we used for the first few months of Maryland Morning is a piece called Lunch with the King from the 1999 movie American Beauty. Now, it's not unusual for shows to use pre-existing music as their themes, but we always knew that at some point we would want our very own musical identity composed just for us. So in August of 2006, Jack Hierman, the founder of a music production company in Baltimore called Clean Cuts, made a very generous offer to us to do just that. The composers at Clean Cuts, and they create music for commercials and video games, TV shows, movies, that kind of stuff. They were kind enough to offer us several theme songs as possibilities. And from that list, as you know, if you listen to us regularly, we chose this one by composer Chris Kennedy. So now, as we approach our 10th birthday, we've decided to change our theme music, and we'd like to ask your help in choosing a worthy successor to Chris's great score. Once again, Jack Hierman was kind enough to help us out. He put us in touch with Rich Isaac. He's the creative director of original music at Clean Cuts, who in turn reached out to the Clean Cuts composing staff. That group includes Chris Kennedy, along with Austin Coughlin and Louis Weeks. They have written 5 samples of music that can be developed into our new theme song, and this morning we'd like to play them for you and ask you which one you think should be the new Maryland Morning theme. So last week, Nathan Sterner and I spoke with Rich Isaac from Clean Cuts, who shed some light on the process that composers at companies like Clean Cuts go through to create musical IDs for shows like ours. Rich, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So are there general rules when it comes to, writing good theme music for shows?
You know, I think probably first, just do no harm. And, in any kind of branding, it's some of the most delicate work that we're asked to do. You know, usually in mixed media, music has one job, and that's just to tell the audience how to feel at any given moment. In any kind of theme or advertising or branding, especially when it comes to mnemonics and stuff like that, there's a lot more at stake. It's not just how, make somebody feel excited or sad or enthusiastic about something. You're representing a brand. You're representing a product, whatever it may be. There's just a little bit more at play there. So you have to really understand who you're working for, get inside of the identity, and try and represent that as best you can.
And Nathan, you're a very experienced hand at choosing music, because in your role as the host of Morning Edition, you've got to choose music to go in and out of various segments. I mean, sometimes the Morning Edition folks have the music, other times, many times, you're the one that decides what music we should hear. You're the one that decides a lot of the music that we hear, you know, on segments that I've done or Judy Russick does or somebody like that. It's a very different thing doing that, choosing music for a particular story, than it is choosing music, as Rich was mentioning, for a show itself.
Yeah, and especially for what we call the Billboard theme, the version of music that starts the show, the first minute of the show before the NPR newscast, because that's something that has to have multiple applications. You don't want something that's too upbeat and perky when the news is really bad. You also don't want something that's somber and slow when the news is good or fun or interesting. You want a piece of music that can work with different stories, that doesn't detract from any of the stories that is being talked about. You also want something that's catchy and simple and hummable, really.
Yeah. Some theme songs that we're very familiar with, for example, the Diane Rehm Show, which happens right after our show. It's a piece by Claude Bowling called Toot Sweet. It's a piece for trumpet and piano. And I guess you know Diane Rehm pretty well. You were at WAMU before you came here to WIPR. How did that come to be her theme song?
Well, that came to be her theme song long, long before I was there. It was chosen probably back in the 80s at the very beginning of the Diane Rehm Show. But I think it was there were a bunch of CDs. Diane chose a piece that she liked, and it's just sort of stayed through. Back before the show had her name, before it was called the Diane Rehm Show, it was called Kaleidoscope. It had the weirdest music that would not have escaped the 70s, and really shouldn't have, and I'm glad it didn't.
All right, so we are, as I said, lucky enough to have the folks at Clean Cuts giving us very original music, completely original music, just for Maryland Morning. We have five samples. Three composers wrote five samples. And Rich, we don't know who wrote which one, but what was the charge that you gave the three composers?
Well, for Maryland Morning, it's a little different because we know the show, we know WYPR, we listen to the show, and we have a long history with you. So we're intimate with this, and you know, this is something we love, and all the composers are really familiar with it. So it was just fun exercise for everybody, I think, to go in and just sort of take, you know, a fresh perspective and take a swing at it.
Yeah, all right. So here are the swings. Now, we're not going to number them. I didn't want to be hierarchical about it. So we're not going to call them 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Instead, we're going to call them by color. And we're going to place these on our website so you'll be able to listen to them again. And there's a number of different ways that you can vote. And we'll tell you about that in a second. But here's the first one we're going to hear. We're going to call this one Green. So this is a possible Maryland Morning theme. Here's Green. All right, so that was Green. All right, we have five of them. That was the first one. Here's another one. This one is Red. All right, so that's the second of five. Here's the third one. We're going to call this one Orange. So continuing our sampling of the five possible theme songs, here's another one. This one's called Blue. All right, here's the final one. This one we're going to call Purple. So that's the final one, Purple. Now, again, we've assigned random colors, right? Green, red, orange, blue, and purple to each one of the songs. This is going to be hard. They're all terrific. They are great. Thanks so much to Chris Kennedy, Louis Weeks, and Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts for suggesting these five possibilities. This really is going to be tough. There are four ways that you can vote, right? And we'll have these themes on the website, so you can go back and check them out. You could come to wypr.org/Maryland Morning. That's the website, and you can leave a comment on our website. You can tweet us, pick your pick. We're at @MarylandMorning. You can email your choice. The address is mdmorning@wipr.org, or you can call us and leave a voicemail message, 410-881-3162, to tell us your favorite of the samples we've just played for you as the possible new Maryland Morning theme song. Again, that phone number, 410-881-3162, and all of this information will be on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Boy, this really is going to be rough, Rich. I mean, this is why we're putting this out to a vote, because, I mean, if we just had to choose among ourselves, it would be very difficult.
Well, I could do it, but I don't know if you want me making the choice by myself, authoritatively.
But that's the thing, Rich. I mean, everybody has an opinion.
Everyone.
Right? I mean, I do have a favorite. I know our senior producer, Rob Civic, has one. Nathan has one. Music is something people have opinions about, isn't
absolutely,
it?
Absolutely. And that's the toughest part of the job. And it's so subjective, and everything's valid. Everyone's opinion is valid when it comes to music.
So once again, you can come to wipr.org/Maryland Morning and leave a comment. You can tweet us @Maryland Morning. You can email your choice, mdmorning@wipr.org, or you can call us and leave us a voicemail, 410-881-3162. So Rich, thank you so much, and please send our warm regards to terrific composers at Clean Cuts, Chris Kennedy, Louis Weeks, and Austin Coughlin. Tell them thanks so much for these great suggestions.
I absolutely will. Thanks for having me.
All right, Nathan, we shall see you soon, of course.
Yes.
Thanks again to Rich Isaac, the creative director of original music, and all of the composers at Clean Cuts. Once again, they're Chris Kennedy, Louis Weeks, and Austin Coughlin. Thanks to all of you for letting us know what music you'd like to hear as the theme music for Maryland Morning. We'll be accepting votes for 2 weeks until the Sunday after Thanksgiving, all right? We'll announce the new music soon thereafter. So you have 2 weeks. Tell your friends. Have them come to the website. Have them give a listen and tell us what you think. 2 weeks till the Sunday after Thanksgiving, and then we will know. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Nathan Sterner.
And when we come back after a break for news, theater critic J. Wynn Russick joins me live here in Studio A to talk about the new musical at Center Stage, The Secret Garden.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wipr.org or find us on Twitter. We're @MarylandMorning. Now back to the show.
Thanks again, Matt. It is Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall, and joining me here in Studio A, our theater critic, J. Wynn Russick. Judy, good morning. Good to see you.
Good morning, Tom. Good to be here.
So The Secret Garden is the last show at Center Stage before they close the doors on Calvert Street, renovate the joint, and then reopen in a year or so,
That's right.
It's a musical. It was made into a Broadway musical back in 1991. I know you saw that production way back when, as well as several others. Are there any significant differences in the version of The Secret Garden that's at Center Stage currently?
Yes, indeed. The musical, of course, is adapted from the young adult novel by Frances Hodgson Burnett. And the major difference from the other productions that I'm familiar with is in the set design. It's by someone named Narelle Sissons. And the set is just infused with the storybook theme. It has huge manuscript pages that are hanging from the back. And the floor is a series of levels that are created from piles of humongous pages. One pile comes out of a trap door, and it becomes seats on a train, and it becomes a bed and a desk and a garden bench. So you never forget that this is a story, and a pretty magical one. There's some lovely effects near the end with the garden that I'm not going to give away here. The whole production, Tom, is really magical. The staging and most of the performances are inspired. And there's even some puppetry. You know, I love that.
Oh, yeah, puppets. Got to have puppets. I've heard great things about this set. It's interesting. You know, sometimes, you know, there's a show, and you say, oh, this actor is just so amazing, or the music is terrific. But this one, the first thing they mention to me is the set.
Although you don't come away, it's not one of those shows where you come away singing the scenery. There's plenty
Other stuff to sing. And the novel, as you mentioned, it's like 100 years old or something, more than 100 years old. It's a classic, a young adult classic. Does this musical stick pretty close to the book? So many people have read the book, you know, it could be a problem if you go in there thinking XYZ is going to happen and ABC happens instead.
Well, it sticks pretty closely. I just reread the book. The script and the lyrics for the musical are by Marcia Norman, and there is one very significant bit of artistic license. The novel is about a little British girl named Mary Lennox. She's orphaned in India and sent to live with her uncle Archibald, and he is himself in mourning for his wife Lily. And Lily's pride and joy was her garden, a walled garden. And after she died, her husband locked the gate and he buried the key. And Mary is determined to find this key. She also finds that she has an invalid cousin hidden away in the house. And the theme of the novel becomes the curative powers of nature, both spiritually and physically. Now, Mary's uncle's estate is in Yorkshire, and it's a pretty forbidding, scary place. And this is where the artistic license comes in. Mary's uncle and his house are haunted. The house is haunted by the spirit of his dead wife.
And a haunted house always makes good theater.
Yes, the haunted house on the hill. But what they have added is that Mary herself is haunted by the ghosts of her parents and their friends and servants who died of cholera in India. And what Marcia Norman has done is she makes these ghosts characters in the musical. Lily's ghost is a very important character, and the others become a kind of chorus. And this particular production that's at center stage gives them lots to do. They sort of serve as furniture, and they serve as trees. I have to admit, the ghosts can be a little bit confusing. It's much clearer than the show was originally on Broadway, but it still can be a tiny bit murky. But, Tom, I have brought you the ghostly chorus introducing Mary to her uncle's haunted house.
And the master hears the whispers on the stairways dark and still, and the spirits speak of secrets in the house upon the hill.
All right, the house upon the hill is actually sung by the company of the Secret Garden that's at center stage. This score, by the way, is by Carly Simon's sister. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. So, Lucy Simon.
Yeah, so what's it like?
Oh, the score is magnificent. It has a kind of sprightly Yorkshire flavor in parts. There's an Indian flavor in other parts. But it's just plain lush, Tom. I think it's worth going to see this show just to hear this score. And it is beautifully sung at center stage. There is a glorious second act duet that's sung by Brandy Burkhart, who has a stunning soprano. She plays Lily, and Kevin Early, who plays her husband, Mary's uncle Archibald. Let's listen to a bit of that.
All right, there's a power ballad for you, huh? That's Brandy Burkhart and Kevin Early. They're part of the cast of The Secret Garden at center stage. And the main character in Secret Garden's a little girl.
Right.
First rule of show business, never work with kids and dogs. I mean, who plays that role here at center stage and how well does she do?
Well, of course, you're talking about little 10-year-old Mary Lennox in the book. And in this production, she's played by Caitlin Cohn. The actress playing her, Caitlin, is actually twice Mary's age. She's an undergraduate on leave from NYU's Tisch School. She first played this role, in fact, in a student production at Tisch, and that production was directed and choreographed by Marcia Milgram Dodge. Dodge then directed Cohn in this professional production, which started at the Cincinnati Playhouse in the Park in September. We are very lucky to have Miss Cohn here in Baltimore. She is a gifted, expressive actor and singer, and her age fooled most of the kids at yesterday's matinee. Performances like hers.
So she's 20 years old?
She's 20 years old.
And she's playing a 10-year-old.
Yeah, she's on leave from college.
Good for her.
And completely convincing in the role. And really, her performance and some of the others in this score and this really creative set make this show a real, real gem. Yesterday, when I saw the matinee, it was one of Center Stage's family performances. There were lots of kids in the audience. And there were a lot of teary-eyed adults at the end.
Isn't that nice? I always like it when that happens. a couple of weeks ago, Kwame Kwayarma, who's the artistic director of Center Stage, stopped by the show, and we talked about some of the stuff that's going on there. And then subsequent to that interview, he announced, I think it was a $32 million campaign to renovate the building and to do a whole bunch of stuff. So share with us some of those details.
Right. They have it's a $32 million campaign, and they have already raised $21.5 million. And it has some really exciting components to it. The head theater on the fourth floor is being redesigned, so it will truly be a flexible space. They'll be able to change the seating configuration in a day. It currently takes weeks. There's a British firm called Charcoal Blue doing that redesign, and they've done London's National Theater and the Royal Shakespeare Company. So they're in very good company. They're going to add a new 99-seat theater also on the fourth floor. This will be a third theater space.
Yeah, smaller space, so they can do
seats,
all sorts
yeah.
of experimental
oh, absolutely.
Stuff.
Absolutely, try mm-hmm. things out. I'm really, really excited about that. The entrance is being redone and named in memory of Peter Kullman, the longtime former managing director who died in August. The lobby's being redesigned. It's going to have a two-story atrium, and there's going to be a dedicated space for community programs and education.
Yeah.
So all of this, everything but the Head Theater, is being designed by Cho Ben Holbeck, and they also did Every Man, and they did Chesapeake, so Baltimoreans should feel right at home there.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun when it gets built. It's going to take about a year or so, a year and a half.
It is. Yeah. They're saying they're going to reopen in January and maybe
we'll
have
see.
Some
we'll
access
see.
In the fall. Yeah,
all right,
exactly.
The Secret Garden continues at Baltimore Center Stage until the Sunday after Thanksgiving. We've got a link to more information on our website at WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. Jay Winrusik, many thanks. We'll see you next time.
Always a pleasure.
Coming up Wednesday on the program, Roberta Kaplan, the lawyer who successfully argued the Supreme Court case that led to the end of the Defense of Marriage Act, poet Daniel Mark Epstein on his latest collection of verse, and just in time for Thanksgiving, Dr. Pam Peek on the relationship between stress and fat. Hope you can join us Wednesday morning on Maryland Morning. Stay tuned to 88.1. At 10:30 this morning, we'll carry President Obama's remarks about the Paris and Beirut attacks. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.